Which is?
Muslim.
No. Crown of all the churches? No.
New church.
Oh. So I am going to admit here in front of you, I was born and raised a proud New Church person. And I don't think that's a bad thing. And I hope by the end of this, you will feel okay calling yourself a New Church person and not be ashamed about it. Because it's a pretty special thing. And so my goal in this presentation is, one, to help you appreciate where you are right now and how miraculous that is. And then the second thing that I really hope is that that will give you some sense of purpose and enthusiasm for performing your role in being a New Church person here in 2017 and beyond. So we are going to look at the history of the churches briefly, and the wonderful thing about this history I'm going to give you is I get to write history how I want it. So I'm going to give you my version that is somewhat researched, and any debate will be squelched. We'll just go with what I have. We're going to talk about the difference when we, in each of these five churches, church-specific, church-universal, we are going to talk about what does the church-specific do? What uses are we supposed to perform? What role should the new church play? And this ultimately gets to boundaries and flexibility issues, which we wrestle with continuously. All right, so history of the churches, where this story is contained, largely is in the story of Nebuchadnezzar's dream. Everybody remember this? He has the statue with the head of gold right down to the feet of iron mixed with clay, and this is talking about the history of the churches from the most ancient church on down through the Christian church, and then what happens to the statue? Crushed by the stone, and that becomes a mountain and fills the whole earth. So in these slides, you're going to be frustrated if you try to read through the whole slide because I'm only going to read parts, because if we read through every slide in full, we're not going to be out of here in an hour. But the carrot I will give to you at the end, all the slides and more bonus content will be in here, and you'll be able to take this with you. So if we go past something that you can't see, no worries, you'll be able to get back to it. So it says, the most ancient church was like morning, spring in the east. The second, the ancient church was like the day, summer in the south. The third, the Israelitish church was like evening, autumn in the west. The fourth, the Christian church, like night, winter, and north. These ordered progressions gave the wise men of antiquity the idea of four ages of the world. They called the first golden, the second silver, the third copper, and the fourth iron. These metals were also used to represent the churches themselves in Nebuchadnezzar's statue. So, out of all these churches, then the rock came and those churches' job was done. And then the doctrine of the new church was to spread, and it was to be the crown of all the churches. Why? One visible God. And that might seem, is that really that spectacular? I think it is miraculous, because it really is trying to combine. I really think this idea, the divine human, we hear that term a lot. It is really trying to pieced together in a perfect union the concept of all might, all power, all divinity, all force, everything, and also at the same time, human. Human. Somebody who loves, understands, is wise, all those things, and putting those together and understanding who God really is. Until we have this idea of the Lord with his arms open inviting us and there reaching out of the boat and pulling us up when we need it. So the new church, the doctrines in the new church explain God with more clarity than ever before. So here's the questionable chart, and like I said, we're not going to argue about this. I'm just going to put it up there, and all the other people can pick away at it as they want. But so there's the five churches, stories from the Word that talk about these things, Adam and Eve, most ancient church, Noah plants a vineyard, beginning of the ancient church, call of Abram, and then eventually the giving of the Ten Commandments, the rise of the Jewish Israelitish church, Christian church. I had a kid get this wrong on a test once, which says I'm not teaching very well. What marks the beginning of the Christian church? Nothing. And I'd even given them the answer. I was like, Jesus Christ was born. Like, that's the beginning of that one. And a story from the Word, I think, talks about the birth of the new church, the woman clothed with the sun giving birth to the male child. The falls of these churches. And there are progressions. Not all falls happen at once, but you get the serpent deceiving Eve, Cain slaying Abel, and then the flood, Tower of Babel for the ancient church. And in the literal sense, you see the Jewish Israelitish church, Israel gets taken to Assyria, Judah falls to Babylon. For the Christian church in the book of Revelation, you have the dragon and the whore of Babylon being defeated. Gray box for the new church. Is there a story about the fall of the new church? No, the Lord didn't put one of those stories in there because it's supposed to be the crown of all the churches that have hitherto existed upon the earth. So presumably there won't be a story in the Word about its end. Each of these churches was founded upon its revelation. So in the most ancient church, it was safe at that time to have this open communication with angels. And when you teach this to children, they think that is the best. Wouldn't that be cool if you could talk to the angels and they could tell you stuff? Is that the best revelation that the Lord has given? No. You're getting it filtered. Even though those angels are really good, you're still only getting their filter. So that wasn't going to last long term. Then the Lord gave the ancient word, and that's a whole topic unto itself. But there was a correspondential ancient word that was the founding of the ancient church. For the Jewish Israelitish church, it was the Old Testament. Christian church, they got their special revelation, the New Testament. And then in our church, the heavenly doctrines, the writings, we have those that marked the beginning of a new church on earth. So gold, silver, bronze, and iron. What do you think the new church is supposed to be?
Pearl?
That's... Could be pearl. Maybe the pearl was the rock that crushed the statue. I don't know.
Gold again.
Could be gold again. Yeah, I do think.
I suggest diamond because it lasts for a long, long time and it hasn't been mentioned yet.
Uh-huh.
Gold like unto clear glass.
Gold like unto clear glass. I tend to think on that, and I'll tell you why in a minute. So in the part of the statute that we just looked at in Daniel, there's sort of the breakdown of that. And it's interesting that the iron and clay feet is kind of that division between the Catholic and the Reformed churches not cohering. So age of life. Now, again, this is where the chart gets a little questionable, so I'm just going to throw that out there. But I think we have two things going. So on the one hand, there's a series in the writings that, you know, basically from the most ancient church on down through the Christian church, it's, you know, a ramp down. It's just, and then the new church comes along. Other series, there is a progressive series where goes most ancient church and then down to the Jewish Israelitish church, which is only the representative of a church, not even a real church in a sense. And then the Christian church in internal character moved back to equivalent with the ancient church, and then presumably the new church would complete the ascent back to eventually a celestial level. So depending on where you're looking, it could be a different series. So for the age of life, this is that macrocosm idea of the history of creation. And I think you have the most ancient church. There's the infancy, the innocence of ignorance, in a sense. Then you have early childhood, Christian church, adolescence. And a lot of this gets into some of New Church educational theory that, you know, the Lord spoke in parables, which are really speak to the opening of the adolescent mind, and that's why teens tend to love the gospel so much. And perhaps the new church, when the final revelation came, is that time when the genuine rational of humanity, in a sense, had opened. So morning, noon, evening, night. And again, I left new church blank. Hopefully. We're not staying in night. We're going to get back to morning and just sort of peaking right around noon. Spring, summer, autumn, winter. And coming from Canada, I'm happy to say winter is hell. So we don't want to stay there. So here's the one where, again, I think this speaks to the series of the downward and then the ascent. The character of the most ancient church, the ruling love, was love to the Lord. Ancient church, in its integrity, love towards the neighbor, mere obedience in the Jewish Israelitish church. And again, this is when they're doing what they're supposed to be doing. Christian church was, it says, an internal character. At the beginning of the Christian church, they were back to love towards the neighbor, the ascent. And so, yeah, I believe the new church, to complete this, eventually is supposed to get back to love to the Lord being the ruling love. All right, so this is even more speculative than the chart. There's a little timeline, and I'm stabbing 100,000 there as the beginning of the most ancient church. Ancient church around 7600 BC. Lasting until Jewish Israelitish church around 1800 BC, Christian church at zero. And yes, I know that's either six or four, depending on what scholars you're looking at. New church, 1770. So really rough breakdown. Here's the sketchy rationale behind that. And again, the purpose of this speculation is to get you to see where you are right now. So I put roughly the beginning of the most ancient church at 100,000. And why? Because so far, the science that I've seen has around that time, suddenly there are thought about burials altars being built, and to me that indicates the beginning of a people that are starting to think about an afterlife. So again, rampant speculation, but I don't see people not thinking about an afterlife, building altars and burying their dead. So speculation, the fall happened, and it's represented by a flood, and this is one of my more favorite theories. Around 7600 BC, up in the area of the Black Sea, you know how that has that pass that connects to the Mediterranean Sea? Well, they discovered that the Black Sea actually at one time was a smaller lake. And it had a civilization around it. And eventually that strait between the Mediterranean Sea and the Black Sea broke through, and the salt water from the Mediterranean Sea came and washed over what was a lake and buried that civilization. And so now it's the Black Sea. And then we read in the writings about, you know, the ancient writers loved to write in correspondences, and we hear that, you know, the ark came to rest on Mount Ararat. So I picture this ancient writer inspired by the Lord watching the breaking of the pass as the water rushes down and, you know, water covers the whole earth. The people are wiped out. Anyhow, this is around 7600 BC. They have dated that catastrophic flood, and it's in that region. So I throw the rise of the ancient church coming sometime after that big flood. Now the fall, which we have in the Tower of Babel, I put around 4000 BC. And the rationale for that is this idea of confused their language and they scattered over the face of the earth. It's around this time where differentiated writing came in and people started recording stuff around those times. So I think that's where remnants of the ancient word got taken around the world as the ancient church was crumbling. So the rise of the Jewish Israelitish church, you know, it begins with the call of Abram out of Ur, and then eventually it is really established in the giving of the Ten Commandments, and then the fall of Israel in 722 BC, fall of Judah 597, rise of the Christian church. And then really there's two parts to that fall. It started its fall in 325 with the Council of Nicaea. And I told somebody this story just last Sunday. Yeah, everybody was on vacation in my congregation. So I knew, you know, it was going to be hardcore, you know, born and bred new church people sitting in the audience. So let's give a hard-hitting new church. So I have TCR 177, which talks all about the heretics of Nicaea, which divided God into three and destroyed everything of the word. And, you know, it was just boom, boom. And as I come out onto chancel, there's a newcomer. Roman Catholic, you know, born and bred. I'd talked to her 2 weeks before, and I'm just like, oh no. it ended up okay. I said to myself, well, you know, the Lord knew she was coming to church. He also knew when I was sitting in my office I was going to write this sermon, so maybe it was meant to be. And she did stay and talk for a while. But yeah, bad things happened at that Council of Nicaea. And then later, Martin Luther rebelled against all the corruption that had happened in the Catholic Church, fell into the other heresy of faith alone. And then eventually we know there was the Last Judgment in 1757, and then the rise of the new church in 1770 AD. And here we are in 2017, and we're all in this room together. So what I want to do now is, so there's a real scan of the five churches up to the present, and I just want to quickly highlight the two things at the end of the Christian church, and then look quickly at some of the history of our church, which you may or may not be familiar with, because again, I'm trying to get you set up for where we are now and where we might be going. So 325, that Council of Nicaea, and this was Athanasius and Arius having a debate, and the short version of it is Arius was saying, you know, there can only be one God, which was great, but he couldn't figure out how to make that happen properly, so he ended up saying that, well, Jesus Christ wasn't actually God, just sort of the best man that had ever lived. Well, if Jesus Christ isn't God, the Christian religion kind of isn't. So that wasn't a good solution. Athanasius, you know, was insisting Jesus Christ had to be God. He couldn't figure out how to put it together into one and ended up dividing God into three separate persons. So that was the first major wrong turn, and that eventually led to the vicarious atonement and a bunch of other things that weren't good. Martin Luther, 1517, he objected to the abuses of papal authority, the selling of indulgences, and the meriting of heaven by good works were his principal contentions. And I did a little research on this. The selling of indulgences got so bad around this time that you could actually prepay for your sins. That's the biggest scam of all time. It used to be the idea was you'd do something wrong, you'd go, you'd confess your sins, and you would be given some kind of reparatory work to do. You know, you did something bad, you got to make amends by a good work. Well, that becomes difficult to administer, so eventually it was, well, I did a bad sin, and well, a good work would be to give some money to the church to make up for that bad thing. And then pretty soon it was, hey, they actually had itemized lists of costing for your sins. And then eventually it even reached a point where you could prepay, so you're going to go off and have a fling on the weekend. I don't want to feel guilty while I'm doing it, so if I prepay the indulgence, I can go and sin guilt-free. And Martin Luther, he was like, this isn't right. So he decided to make a change. Unfortunately, he didn't heed an angel's warning, and he settled in on this thing of, it's apart from any good works, any merit, you know, it's what you believe, it is faith alone that is going to save you, and that also was a wrong turn. So the Age of Enlightenment comes in around this time, and again, think of that idea of the human race has been developing, and I think this is that era of, when Matthew was talking the other day about, you know, why did the Lord have to wait? Well, one of the reasons was the human race was not ready for the rational truths of this nature until the human race had really developed to the point where that type of truth was appropriate. So lots of great philosophers came in, René Descartes and so on, that was sort of setting the scene for the Lord's second coming. Then, in the middle of that period there, 1688, Swedenborg's born, the Last Judgment happens in 1757, and I'd forgotten that definitive thing which Jamie said, how can it be a year when there's no time and space in that world? But yeah, miraculous. So there was, and my answer to that is, the Lord is trying to give us an indication of his power, an order that there was 1,757 years of mess going on, and the Lord cleaned that up in a year. So it doesn't take him long to set things straight. 1770, June 19th, you know, this is an awesome event. The 12 disciples who follow him in the world then take these new teachings, the heavenly doctrines, the proclamation of the second coming of the Lord, and they go throughout the spiritual world proclaiming that the Lord God Jesus Christ reigns. All right, and then Swedenborg dies. So here's some stuff you may or may not know that I think is pretty exciting. So in the spiritual world, 1770, June 19th, there's the disciples going out. And here, 17 years later, on this earth, the first new church worship service is held. So while Swedenborg had been writing these heavenly doctrines from the Lord, people were reading them as they were coming out, and some people were coming to, wow, this is a new church. This is the fifth church, you know, as you're coming along and saying, wow, we're in this final dispensation in the history of the human race kind of thing. So they hold this worship service. Robert Hindmarsh ends up being the first baptized. And they had to select by lot who was going to officiate because there was no new church people to do new church baptisms. And notice it says, the same day a dissenter's license is obtained, thus officially establishing the new church on earth as a dissenting sect from the established religion of the old and the dead church. So these early new churchmen, reading some of the things we said, we're different. Like, this is the new church. This is the fifth church upon the earth. And they wanted to make that distinction that we are a new church. Notice, 5 years later, already there's an initial schism in the church between Kluse and Hindmarsh. And it really settled, and again, you get my version of it. Hindmarsh was the one, you know, that really honed in on, we are separate. Distinct church, new dispensation, apart from the old dead church. We're over here, they're over there. Kluse was much more of a permeationist, saying, look, the way to do this is we'll just subtly infiltrate Christianity. We'll preach from their pulpits the doctrine, and before they know it, there'll be new church. So we'll slide it in as we go. And so there was this debate, which is the way to go? Say, we're Christian, and we're just going to slide in some new Christian teachings while you're unaware, or we're new church, we are a totally different breed of Christianity and thus need to be a separate dispensation. Which one do you think we sort of came out of? Jamie?
I just wanted an observation. For those U.S. historians, 1787 was when the Constitution of the United States was ratified.
Ah, pretty cool. So along with this, Hindmarsh ends up saying, look, to preserve this separate dispensation, we need an episcopal form of government, priestly-led rather than a congregational form of government, which is more democratic. I put the last line there, the general church today still maintains an episcopal form of government and has generally followed the separatist views of Hindmarsh. I would say that right now is in question. I think our church has a debate about whether we should be an episcopal form of government, whether we should be more congregational, more democratic with voting and things like that. We're having the same debates that only took 5 years to get going after the first new church service, and we're back with those again. For historians, you might like this one. I did a little study once on John Hargrove. He was ordained as a new church minister. And in 1802, he was friends with Jefferson. He got invited to preach before Congress, which was pretty awesome, right in the beginning, you know, of the U.S. being set up. And he preached on the four leading doctrines of the New Jerusalem. That, I would have loved to have been there and hear him sharing the second coming of the Lord with the Congress of the United States. Just amazing. It says he was well received, and he was asked to preach again the following night. So pretty cool. Academy of the New Church, 1876, June 19th. So from 1770, we're now 106 years into it, and the Academy is formed. Council of 12 men is chosen. Benet is selected as the chancellor. The Academy had 9 theological students, more than convention had enrolled at Urbana and Waltham. Thus, the Academy, this is my bias, was now the only real place for new church education, especially since for many years, Urbana and Waltham were in reality only secular schools. So Urbana had started out as the first new church university, and they eventually got pulled into secularism. And I went to their website about 5 years ago, and if you dive like 60 clicks in, you can still find that at one time, you know, there was Emanuel Swedenborg and something. But other than that, it's not a shred new church anymore. What's that? Yes. So it's well buried, and let's just hope our college does not go in that direction. 1881, first publication of New Church Life. 1890, another split. So about 100 years after the first split, the General Church officially splits from convention. 317 people left the approximately 6,000 of convention. And again, you get my take on the main reasons for the split. First and foremost was the authority of the writings. And the 317 who walked away said, these are divine. And because they're divine, it means you can't pick and choose. You have to accept what they say. And the other ones really settled more on the idea that they were very inspired, intelligent, wise works, good books for the church, but not divine, and therefore not infallible. And so they split over that. And another reason tied to that was education. And again, a little bit of that separatist or permeationist theory where convention was more and more sort of wanting to be a part and immersed in the community around them without distinction. And the general church was more saying, no, we want to educate our kids separately because there's a lot of falsities in the established doctrine of the old church, and we don't want them to be confused by that. Yes?
Just a point of clarification.
Yes.
The 1798 reference was when Jefferson was vice president, so he was president of the Senate. John Adams was president at the time.
Yes, it was 1802. Hargrove was ordained in 1798 and asked to preach in 1802. Is that when Jefferson was president?
Yeah,
1801 to 1809. Yeah. So 1927, fresh off the split from convention, another controversy happens. The Hague controversy, known as the Dutch position. I'm not going to go through this whole thing. Eventually, It led to the split in 1937. Notice 117 members this time resigned from the general church and established the Lord's New Church. And again, this controversy was over how we hold the writings. The general church, again, I think their position, simply put, was they're divine, they're infallible, and it says what it says, and that's what you go by. And this Dutch position that was opening up was, yes, they are divine, but a regenerate, enlightened person through correspondences can see things deeper in the writings that aren't explicitly stated. De Charmes and Odner and Pendleton and others said, that's pretty dangerous, because it kind of sounds like then the priest or the enlightened person can begin to say things that aren't actually there and then tell you that, well, you just don't get it because you're not enlightened. So again, it really did come down to how we hold the revelation that we were given that led to that split in 1937. 2017, how many years are we after that? 80 years? And, you know, we are having lots of debate in our church about directions, things we're going to do, not do. And I think a lot of them come back to how do we hold the heavenly doctrines? And I think if you look at some of this past history and you see the debates and the wranglings leading up to it, we're kind of debatey and wrangly right now. And I think this stuff will eventually get sorted out again. And I think when scholars look back at it sometime in the future, they're going to say, ultimately it really came down to how they held the heavenly doctrines was at the root of the dissension. Okay. Whew. We're going to have to go fast. Yes?
People are currently part of the general church right now.
Our church? Roughly 5,000 to 7,000-ish. Now that's signed up members. That doesn't include children, people who are worshiping, never became members.
How does English Conference fit into this?
So Conference, my belief is they're sort of the British side of convention. Now, where they are now, I would say Conference is far less liberal than Americanized convention.
But there's still the divinity of the writings.
Yeah.
Still an issue.
Correct. I would say Conference would not say they are divine or infallible.
And they're more congregational, which is sort of
correct.
A style that we
yep. Somewhere over here. Again, it's so hard to do it by numbers. Because, I mean, I even look at our congregation, you know, we have some who are members of the general church who I haven't seen in 10 years, and they count as a number, and then I have some people who, you know, come almost every Sunday, and they're not members, so they're not counted it. Very hard to figure numbers, which is why we shouldn't count the people. Okay. Sidebar. Not going to go there. All right. So we really are going to have to do this part. We're not going to have time to look at a lot of the slides. But so the big setup here is through all this history of the five churches, and then in our short little new church history, we've already had three splits and schisms. And here we are, 2017. Got the final revelation the Lord is going to give to us in this written form. The promise that it's going to be the crown of all the churches that have hitherto existed upon the earth. And for whatever reason, the Lord chose you to be a part of this church at this time. Or if not a part of this church, to have come in contact with the heavenly doctrines at this point in time. To me, that is a miraculous thing. To think about, you're at, you know, right near the beginning of the final church on earth, the new church. And so the decisions that we make here are really important. It makes a difference how you hold the second coming of the Lord and the truths that He gives you. And we each have a part to play in this new church that is descending. From God out of heaven. So, long and short part of these slides. I believe the new church, as the four previous churches before, our role right now is to play that part of the church specific. And why? Because of the worship that we had. The thing that made each of these churches special and set apart, as it were, from the other churches was the role they had to play based on the revelation that they had received. So for the new church, we have the heavenly doctrines, the second coming of the Lord. That is what distinguishes us and sets us apart. And so we have a role to play while we have those heavenly doctrines that no other church can play. We're the only show in town right now. And when you think percentage-wise how small we are, we're tiny, and our role is vital. So this is that part that our church is special, because we have more interior truths than others, handed to us on a platter. And I often reflect, why me, Lord? Why out of the 7 billion people on this earth did I get lucky enough to be exposed to these? The only answer I can come up with is the Lord in His providence knew that for me there was no other way I was getting to heaven. But think about that. You're part of that group that right now out of 7 billion people has been exposed to the second coming of the Lord. That's amazing.
That makes us like the tiny little seed.
Yeah.
Very powerful, but only if the Lord makes it happen.
Yep. Absolutely. So then we have the universal church. And it is with all those who acknowledge the divine and live in charity. So yes, there are lots of good Christians, lots of good Jews, lots of good Muslims who acknowledge God and are trying to live a life of charity. That's great. They have a job to do. They are the body of the Lord's church. But until they are exposed to the heavenly doctrines, they cannot perform the function of the church specific. And so when I think of what we're supposed to be doing, we have to hone in on our duty, our role, is to perform the function of the church specific, because nobody else can do that. And so if we say, well, we want to be the church universal and not engage in the church specific function, well, who's going to do that? The Mennonites in my community can't pick up that function because they don't have yet those interior truths. So I think we have to stay focused on what it is we have to offer to the world. The other thing we're told is there always has been and always will be a church universal and a church specific. So the church the Lord has provided for, there's always going to be these two sides. So I think we have to stay focused on what it is we have to offer. So what uses? The church specific is to be the heart and lungs. And so it says, for the word in the church, although existing with comparatively few, is life to all the rest. Is life to all the rest. So long as the heart is sound, life is possible for the neighboring viscera. So we have a heart and lung function to perform. And one of the things I've said before about this, that's not showy. We don't see the heart and lungs. We see the beauty of the body. We see the bulging muscles. We see the pretty face. That's what we notice, and that's what gets recognition. And I think that's why we constantly have this pull to want to be church universal type thing, because that's recognized. And I'll admit to jealousy in that regard. We have a great Mennonite Central Committee, one of the best charities in our region, and they get lots of props for the good things that they do. And there's a part of me that says, man, I wish that that could be me. And it could be. Except I actually think they do it a lot better than I probably would. And they can't offer what we offer. And I think what we have to offer is the sharing of the heavenly doctrines with the entire globe. That's what I think our purpose and our mission has to be at this sliver in history, because only a fraction of people have been exposed to the Lord's second coming.
You don't want to do questions now.
Go ahead.
The heart and lungs can't exist by themselves, which we know, it's obvious. They have to have a body. And we know that the body, the people who are part of the body, can go to heaven. So we have to keep being a heart and lungs, but how, it doesn't feel that urgent to make sure that everybody knows the teachings. Does that make sense? I believe in sharing them, and I believe it makes life easier if you do know the teachings.
Yeah, so...
You can't get everybody to be heart and lungs.
Well, the heart pumps oxygenated blood to the whole body, every cell.
Yeah.
Correct. And I think where this is going for me, and why I feel we need to know where we are in the history of the churches and therefore what our role is supposed to be. So yes, let me go next slides here. So we can provide that light. We can provide the oxygenated blood for the body. It's diffused to the circumferences in every direction. Now notice, it says, it is sufficient that there be a church where the word is, even if it consists of comparatively few, for even in that case, the Lord is present by means in the whole world. So yes, we are comparatively few, but what I would say, just on a numerical basis, if we have a church universal body, you know, that's good people who acknowledge the divine, trying to follow. Let's say half the human race are good people. Sound fair? All right, so 4 billion good people in the world looking to the Lord, trying to live a good life. And let's say 100,000 people have been exposed to the heavenly doctrines. That's a teeny tiny heart and lungs trying to keep a pretty big body healthy. And so that's where I think, yes, it can be comparatively few, and wouldn't it be great if there was 1 million people So that the heart and lung is more vibrant and functioning and able to send that oxygen out throughout the body and keep it even more healthy. Because yes, the church universal will be more healthy the healthier the heart and lungs are. And so I feel like we are in that baby part of the new church in a historical context, but we could do a lot more to be a healthier heart and lungs.
In the first part of the Arcana, Swedenborg is talking about Reformation and has a statement somewhere about very few get to this stage. So our job is vitally, vitally necessary.
Yeah, it is. We can also provide for that sound understanding of the Word. And this is something that has really impacted me over the years in the role I am. I believe there are a lot of people want to believe the Word. And they see contradictions in it, paradoxes that they don't know how to put together. They've been indoctrinated in a falsity. And then they come across the heavenly doctrines that show them how it is all true, and you just see the light go on, and now it's easy for them to see the Lord as that divine, loving, all-wise God, and it makes sense to them. We can help them do that. We can provide conjunction with the angels of heaven and the Lord through these doctrines. Yes, we can be the internal for the external. Now notice this number right here. Members of the internal church are those who have brought a specific quality to their good by means of interior truths such as belong to the internal sense of the word. You are blessed having been given that internal sense of the word. And so it says, those who belong to the internal church excel in understanding and wisdom over those who belong to the external church, and thereby also occupy a more internal position in heaven. It qualifies your good. So the more you know about the Lord and how He operates, the better person you can be. So what role should we play? We can allow people to enter with understanding into the mysteries of faith. That is really critical. Now, here's the thing. So, note this teaching. It says, when the end of a church is at hand, the interior things of the word of the church and of worship are revealed and taught. This is done that the good may be separated from evil. There is a separation because the interior things of the word of the church and of worship, which are celestial and spiritual, are received by the good but are rejected by the evil. And then that last one saying that the faith of the former churches do not agree in a third part, not even in a tenth part. If they're together, such a collision and conflict result that everything pertaining to the church of man perishes. Do you think that was probably a passage that Hindmarsh had in his back pocket when he was saying, we need to be separate? Like, there has to be a distinction in the churches. And the distinction can help make it healthy. We can provide spiritual medicine for the other churches by allowing those rational truths from the heavenly doctrines to come forward. So, what should we be doing? We got to get the Second Advent out there. I had a question with a guy in Vancouver. He's like, is the Second Coming an event that happened? Or is it something that is happening? And it's like, it's both. There was a last judgment in 1757, and there was a birth of a new church, as it were, in 1770. That was an event, but it's hard for the Second Coming to happen in somebody who has never seen the heavenly doctrine. So we can do something about getting that message out there. Yes, the Lord does call us to be watchmen and defend the holy city, New Jerusalem, against attacks of evil from the outside. So this last section I am going to bypass for you because we are at the end of time. But interesting things to read about boundaries. Boundaries, good fences make good neighbors. And we should be clear about who we are and what we offer and not try to be all things to all people. Yes, boundaries do keep people out. Having just finished New Church Day, one of those visions of the Holy City, New Jerusalem, 12 gates, are they open or closed?
Open.
Open, facing?
All directions.
Yeah. Can anybody just wander in? There are angel guards above the gates, and it says outside are the sexually immorals and everybody who loves a lie and so on and so forth. So, yes, the Lord is inviting everybody in, but there is a wall and there are angels above saying, do you really want to live according to these things or not? Because that's how it works. The belt, yes, boundaries help keep things together. Boundaries, I think, also allow us to deal with other people who are not maybe yet in. To say, I can see where you are and your understanding of things. Here's where we are and ours. And maybe at some point they would like to come and join. So my questions for you to discuss as you head out. What does it mean that the new church is the crown of all the churches? What does that mean to you here today? And is it proud to be a new church person? What I want you to think about, there used to be the heydays of, you know, rah-rah new church, everybody else's rubbish, bosh. Every Swedenborgian has his hammer whacking other people on the head. So that might have been, you know, the proud to be new church thing that isn't so good, but I feel like we've swung to the other end of the spectrum where we almost don't care that we're new church. And I think there is a should be a healthy sense of, yeah, I'm darn lucky to be a part of this church, and I want to share those teachings with others. So other questions? Yes, sir. So folks, that's my presentation. I really hope you can appreciate this little slice of history you're in and maybe feel some zeal to do your part, which the Lord dropped you here at this slice in time to do. Thank you.